Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. And today I'm delighted to welcome a good friend, Dr. Chris Streather, who I've had the pleasure of knowing for several years now. He's a man who's achieved a great deal, faced some real challenges, and always has a vibrant and positive attitude. Chris currently serves as Group Chief Medical Officer and Deputy CEO for London's Royal Free Hospitals. He obtained his bachelor's and master's at Oxford and his medical degrees from London's St. Thomas's Medical School and became a member and then fellow of the Royal College of Physicians. Chris served as senior registrar at Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge and then the National Kidney Research Fellow at King's College Hospital, London, and was then appointed as a consultant nephrologist at another of London's venerable institutions, St. George's. During that time, he was active in clinical research, including work in non-invasive cardiac screening of transplant patients, and was physician lead for the pre-dialysis and transplantation clinic. In 2004, Chris moved into an administrative leadership role, having already chaired the Division of Medicine and represented consultants at the British Medical Association. He then served in various other leadership and board roles and has a unique combination of experience as an acute care sector CEO, successfully redesigning complex tertiary services, leading a large network crossing provision, commissioning, academia and commercial sectors, and in independent healthcare delivery. Chris is married with three children. He ran two marathons in his 40s, the first time raising £13,000 for a kidney charity. And I think you can see that he has a devotion to that particular organ. And he enjoys endurance cycling tours, including the Étape du Tour, which is an amateur ride of a Tour de France stage, and the Dolomite Marathon, each of which he's done twice, and the Geneva to Venice Haute Route, as well as the 2018 274-kilometer Liège-Bastogne-Liège one-day race. I have to tell you, Chris, I'm exhausted just reading this. You know, during the COVID-19 lockdown, Chris told me that he became mildly obsessed with sourdough. When not baking, cycling, working, or spending time with his family, he has guilty pleasures, bird watching, and supporting Reading Football Club. Dr. Chris Streather, welcome.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm excited about some of the topics that we're going to talk about.
And in fact, one of them you just hinted at, it's good to be here in more ways than one. I think your statement really resonates. But before we get into the meat of it, I want to talk a little bit about growing up and supporting Reading Football Club, which I've been a lifelong football supporter, and you and I have been to watch my Tottenham Hotspur team play on a number of occasions. You've yet to take me to Reading. We'll have to go there. But tell me a little bit about Reading Football Club, because it's actually older than Spurs.
Yeah, we were founded in 1871, and we're allegedly the oldest football club south of the Trent River. And so I'm quite proud of Reading. When I was growing up, we were always useless, and we were in the bottom two divisions of English football, whereas for the last 25 years, we've been in the top two divisions. So I think we're now doing well, but I'm an optimist. But most of my friends who support proper football clubs like Spurs or Liverpool, I don't call Chelsea a proper football club, denigrate Reading. And we also have the eccentric nickname of the Biscuitmen, because Huntley and Palmer's, which was one of the big sort of national biscuit companies, had their factory right in the middle of Reading. Reading's famous for very little, but it was famous when I was growing up for biscuits. And there was this gorgeous smell of biscuits when you drove through the town. Secondly, it was famous for imprisoning Oscar Wilde, which was a thing we should probably celebrate rather less.
Yeah, absolutely. And you told me that Majeski, the guy who was the benefactor, really, of the modern Reading, had worked in the Huntley and Palmer factory as a young man.
Yeah, he was a first-generation Polish immigrant, and he worked on the shop floor at Huntley and Palmer's, his first job out of school, and still loves the town and its heritage.
Well, that's a lovely story. So let's get into medicine, healthcare, your professional activities. During your tenure as clinical director at St. George's, you kept the system on budget, which in and of itself is a rarity, I think, and you had a surplus each year and successfully bid to become one of four regional trauma and eight regional hyperacute stroke units. What did this experience teach you about leadership?
So I think there are a number of things. The money was quite a big deal. We were part of a national program for financial turnaround, which there's been a lot of it in the health service since then. But we were the first time one of the big four accountancy firms had come in and worked in partnership with the health service and the regional health authority and St. George's to try and turn things around. And so I hope we approached financial health in a reasonably sophisticated rather than a crude slash and burn way. But I suppose the thing about leadership it taught me was the sort of respect for experts, that sometimes, you know, however hard you work and however much goodwill you've got, you do need to ask for help and not be too proud for ask for help. I think the other thing about leadership at the time was I'm quite a hero worshipper, and I like working for, you know, people who impress me, people who are clever, people who know things I don't. So I work for a great boss called Peter Homer, and he managed to engender a sort of fantastic team spirit in the executive team at the time. And I think a number of us started in leadership positions at the same time that he started. And there was a real nice feeling of, you know, of we're all in it together. And I think it's a thing actually that translates to sport, developing that sort of, you know, a set of collective goals and an esprit de corps is really helpful. I think the second thing I learned about leadership is there are people who have natural leadership, you know, capability, but also it's like everything else. It's something you need to work on. You need to work on your development. And I think throughout my career, I've tried to, you know, learn new skills and be open to the idea of development. So I think team sport, and it's a continuous process of development.
You know, it's interesting that the observations you make. I've had the privilege to meet a lot of really powerful, inspirational people like Richard Branson. And my experience of them has been that rather than being imperious, pompous, and self-righteous, they're very humble, very understated, more interested in listening than talking. And in fact, there was a great podcast. It was called "Listen to Lucy," a lady who wrote for the Financial Times, and she presented some data that CEOs, leaders who had sort of imposter syndrome, felt that they shouldn't be there, that they, you know, they did much better than people who thought they knew it all. Is that your impression?
Yeah, I think. I've done quite a lot of jobs in my career, so I've done a number of interviews. And I think one of the things that's a thing you need to try and convey in an interview for a, you know, a senior position is it's a good thing to be ambitious, because ambition appended to good values is the way to get good things done. But also there's humility. And I think that combination of humility and ambition is a real sort of, you know, essential part of the specification for leadership. And it's quite difficult to get that balance between ambition and humility right. But I think the best leaders do that. And I think the examples you use show that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'd like to continue exploring some of your experiences and achievements. I think it was in 2008, after a review by Professor the Lord Aradazi, you helped develop a stroke strategy for London. Tell us about the situation, well, what it was like before that, what changes were implemented as a result of your work, and what you think you achieved.
Okay, so at the time, about 30 different hospitals in London were delivering acute stroke care. And the Royal College of Physicians through Tony Rudd, who became the clinical director for London Stroke, in fact, after me. But Tony Rudd, who's a brilliant stroke physician, they developed a scheme called the Sentinel Audit. And essentially, you know, it's the idea about sunlight being the best disinfectant. They looked at the data in terms of stroke care, picked out, you know, a number of important measures which were surrogates or direct measures of quality, and then plotted stroke units around the country, essentially in a league table. So you could put people in rank order. And broadly, of the 30 units in London that were delivering stroke care, about eight probably were delivering a standard that was, you know, up to the best national standards. About 10 were using average, you know, not in its nicest way, were about average. And 10 really weren't good enough at all. And part of that was you get better at things by practicing. And if you have 30 stroke units in London, there aren't enough people coming in every day that you get really slick about doing the basic things you need to do well. And also the number of skilled nurses and therapists and radiologists and stroke doctors gets diluted across the capital. So we had a principle when we were redesigning care that we would set standards using the Sentinel Audit of the College of Physicians as a baseline, set standards that in order to have the right to deliver hyperacute stroke care, you needed to deliver those standards. And we essentially commissioned, designed an idealized stroke pathway that can meet those standards. And then we made a principle that there was a number of stroke units that was less than 10, we arrived at 8 in the end, that was the optimum number to maintain the skills of the professionals delivering the stroke care and get them, doing a high volume of care, which meant they were good at it, but also to get the right compromises about travel time. So we didn't want to say, you'll have two units in the centre of London, because then if you had a stroke in Epsom at rush hour on a Friday night, you'd never get there. So there were trade-offs between volume and numbers and geography and eight. And we used maths to work out what that was. We did quite a lot of sophisticated modelling, and eight was the answer we came up with. And immodestly, London has, I think pretty objectively, the best stroke care of any capital city in the world now. And that's a legacy of that work that was now done 12 or 15 years ago.
That must make you very proud. And if you look at the knock-on effects, there's a friend of mine in New York. He had a stroke whilst he was in the gym working out, and he'd literally crawled back to his room. And his wife called me and said, what should I do? And I said, well, get off the phone with me and call the ambulance. And she said, I've already done that. They're on their way. And it was really impressive. They had this sort of brain attack approach to treating it with a group of specialists. They had a telemedicine data link from the ambulance to the hospital. Impressive stuff. What are some of the innovations that are coming down the pike in stroke care, other than what you implemented by rationally creating centers of excellence?
So we started this in the infancy of thrombolysis, so clot-busting treatments. They've become more sophisticated since then. So there are ways of giving, highly localized clot-busting drugs rather than systemic clot-busting drugs. And also the sort of add-on to that is in suitable individuals, it's possible actually using interventional radiology to extract clots from the brain circulation. That requires a great deal of sort of sophisticated infrastructure, and it's only suitable for some patients. But that's the sort of the next big thing, really. The impact of thrombolysis and the impact of what we did and then subsequent development since is mainly to reduce disability after stroke. And clot-busting drugs and most of the medicine reduces and it's essentially moves. You can either be have a trivial disability, a moderate disability, or you know, severe or fatal. And essentially, thrombolysis moves you to the tier below. So trivial becomes, you know, becomes nothing. Moderate becomes trivial, and some of the severe disability becomes moderate if you get it in early enough to the right people. But what it doesn't do is reduce mortality. So I think that the next big challenge in stroke care is the prevention agenda, is to stop people getting strokes in the first place. We've done a lot on this, you know, worldwide by treating atrial fibrillation, uneven heartbeat, and giving people oral anticoagulants when they have uneven heartbeats is probably the single most important preventative measure you can do in a late stage. At an early stage, it's stopping people smoking, getting people to exercise, and treating blood pressure with energy.
Yeah, absolutely. And educating people about the signs of stroke fast, right? FAST, yeah. So I'd like to switch topics a little bit because in your career, you've become involved in coaching. And many people dismiss the thought of coaching for life. Tennis, yes. Piano, yes. Life, leadership, that's poppycock. But I know you're a believer in personal leadership development and have participated in the Future Leadership, Future Vision Leadership Program and the Royal Free Executive Coaching Program. And I now know that you help others. What did you personally get from these experiences? And what do you like to impart to those you coach? And by the way, I used to think it was all poppycock until someone started working with me and it was like, bloody hell, this really makes sense.
Yeah, I think the medical attitude, and I was the same as you, Jonathan, the medical attitude towards leading is that, you know, the talented, you know, gifted amateurs make the best leaders. And I think the best leaders are gifted. And to be a good leader, you have to have aptitude. But it's like any other skill. It's trainable. You don't become Roger Federer without practicing. He's brilliant, and he's, you know, he's got amazing genes, hasn't he? But he practices like no one other. You know, if you're James Anderson at cricket, you've bowled thousands of overs and repeated the same function. It's the same about leadership. I mean, I think it's very easy to, you know, to flail around without direction if you try and just rely on natural ability. I've been on a number of formalized leadership courses, and including at the King's Fund, and I've also been the recipient of executive coaching on a number of occasions. And as you said, I've trained as an executive coach myself, and have a number of, within the Royal Free Group, number of coaching clients at the moment. I think the best thing about coaching, and it's really difficult when you're a coach to sit on your hands, but is this, it's a bit like the Socratic dialogue where you talk with your coach and they lead you to come out with the answers for yourself. And that's much more empowering than I suppose a menu of things that you should do or a list of instructions. It does require more patience and skill from the coach. But this idea of getting people to the point where they find the answers rather than telling them what to do is the thing that I most like. I think the other thing about some formal training is it does allow you to, again, a golf analogy. You don't want to be putting with a driver or driving with a putter or, you know, playing off the fair with a pitching wedge. There are times when you need to tell people what to do, and sometimes we're reluctant to do that. But there are times when you need to be more coaching style and enabling other people to do things. And then there are also times for building consensus and times for being decisive. So I think with coaching and with proper, you know, focused leadership development, you can work out which club to take out of your bag on which occasion.
Yeah, interesting. The it harkens back to your earlier comment, Chris, about humility in leadership. And, you know, the chap who actually started EMG Health, the platform on which we're talking, is a very, very strong believer in building a values-based organization, that's the fundamentally most important thing. And we've talked a lot about leadership, and it comes down to human compassion, about how you treat other people. And the guy that I worked with, he gave me a task, and in a second I'm going to ask you to come up with something to tell people who are listening in who haven't thought about this, that they could try. The thing that he got me to do was to say, write down some rules. Write down your rules of what you will not tolerate in an interaction. And for me, it was five things. One of which was, I'm not going to work with, and this is the clean version, rule number one was, do not work with people who are unpleasant in any way, shape, or form. Number two was an endeavor to learn something new from every interaction. Number three was, have fun in the process. Work shouldn't be work, it should be fun. Number four was, leave the world a better place. Number five was, succeed. Failure's not an option. Just never give up. And so can you think of any piece of homework you would give people who are new to the concept of coaching?
Yeah. I mean, people talk about the sort of growth mindset. So I think it's be open to learning. One of the things we're doing in the organization is some work on reverse mentoring. So actually, when you mentor people, you learn stuff from the people you mentor, as well as, you know, in the other direction. So I think be willing to learn from people. And I said at the beginning, you know, I worked for Peter Homer, who was brilliant. And, you know, looking out for good role models and picking up what you can learn from them and take into your own practice. Peter used to have a really good habit of writing handwritten thank you notes to people who'd done good things. So he'd give feedback. It was succinct, and he gave it quickly, you know, soon after the event. Right. And he'd use handwritten letters often, particularly in this day of electronic communication. There's something really gorgeous and personal about handwritten letters.
Yeah.
So role models and good behavior. I agree with you about, you know, the sort of treating people well and, you know, treating people with kindness. And it comes back to you. Acts of kindness are often reciprocated, and kindness is actually catching. I think it's enormously important to have fun. You know, we spend 10 hours a day at work, don't we? I enjoy going to work, and I've been ill recently and was glad to get back. You know, and so you have to enjoy it and make it fun. I've got a bit of a reputation in our leadership group for making, you know, badly timed corny jokes. But again, we're talking about people you look up to. I look up to David Sloman, who was my boss at the Royal Free and is now the head of the NHS in London a great deal. And There's a difference between formality and seriousness. So I'm very serious about work, and I'm very serious because the things we're doing, we're using public money, and we're doing stuff which is looking after, you know, people's lives at the most important time for us. So I'm deadly serious about it. I'm very informal.
Yeah.
And people mistake, you know, formality for seriousness. And they're absolutely not the same thing. It's really important to be professional about things. And then I think, you know, the other thing is being professional. It's drilled into us, Jonathan, isn't it? The professionalism aspects of medicine. And you know, I see the General Medical Council as a higher authority than my employer in terms of my behaviour. But I think some of the stuff about education and development and coaching we've been talking about, I think, is about being professional. It's about you doing the best job you possibly can, and being open to learning skills about how you can continue to do the best job you possibly can.
Yeah, beautifully put. Your comment about handwritten notes. I had a boss who had little cards that just had his name at the top, and he would write little handwritten thank you notes on these cards, and you just get a little envelope with a card, and it would just say, you know, something short and sweet, but to know that you'd be noticed. Human beings get off on that. So, yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about healthcare systems. The term integrated care systems user, a great, what does that actually mean? And what opportunities are presented by doing it? I mean, I lived in the United States for a number of years, and I came back to the UK where I was born, and the entire lexicon of healthcare delivery has changed every time I turn around. What is an integrated care system? What does it mean, and how does it help?
Okay, so I'm quite an Americophile. I know you are, but it's like your frustrating brother, America, isn't it? It's they're absolutely brilliant, and you love them, but frustrating, and you know, in other ways. And I think if you look at healthcare, the absolutely best healthcare and best examples of healthcare, I think, in the Western world are in the United States. But the average standard is I'm sorry to say reprehensible, but sometimes in this country, and it's this bit about, you know, a closed mindset, we're inclined not to look at the really brilliant things that go on there. And I think in patches they've nailed integrated systems. So a really good integrated system takes the patient right from staying healthy, you know, a health service, not an illness service, right the way through from that to very complex intervention when people are sick. And you can't see the joins between those bits. Sometimes the National Health Service, despite being in America, in places like Intermountain and Kaiser and Geisinger, they do that very well. And what they also do when they do it very well is they've lined up the paying for it. So often the plan or the insurance plan is integrated into the whole system. It isn't, you know, Geisinger and Kaiser and Intermountain. And despite the fact that we're called a national health service in this country, there is a divide between physical health and mental health, between primary care and hospital care, between commissioners and providers, and to be honest, between regulators and providers, and as well as patients falling into the gap between different bits of the system when they have complex, you know, conditions which last from, you know, prevention through to complex intervention. There's also a lot of transactional argy-bargy between the different bits of the system I've described, which just add no value at all. They poison relationships and they cost money. So I think if we get integrated care systems right, we'll take out that argy-bargy and that transactional cost, which is an opportunity to invest that in better care. So the artificial divide between the commissioners who buy healthcare on behalf of the government and the providers, if we make it work, we swept away, which will be a good thing. And I hope the fighting between, you know, I don't, particularly primary care and secondary care and mental health and physical health, which doesn't help a single patient or a single taxpayer, I hope that will not be baked into the system and be necessary. It is important, and we need to make the integrated care systems work. It is important that we don't lapse into old habits. But David Nicholson, who used to run the health service, used to talk about spectators, commentators, and players. And again, I suppose back to sport. You might have 100,000 people in the stadium, and you might have 25 commentators. But what you want to be is you want to be a player on the pitch. You want to be, instead of saying how bad it is and how you'd like to make it better, you want to be on the pitch making it better. And his exhortation to leaders was always be a player on the pitch. And so as integrated care systems develop and the formal appointments into them are being made in October this year, you know, I'm quite anxious, and colleagues at the Royal Free are anxious too, that we get on the pitch and try and make it work well. And as I say, I think there are models in the world where it does work well, and we should learn from them. And we tend to be a bit insular in the UK, and we need to get over that a bit.
Well, well said. I have to say, having practiced on both sides of the duck pond, that America is insular as well, and fails to learn the lessons that other healthcare systems have seen. But, you know, it's impossible to have any conversation at the moment without thinking about COVID. It's imposed itself on every narrative, and not just COVID, but the future pandemics that even the most churlish will surely now accept are going to occur. So how do you see the National Health Service post-COVID? And what about the global view of healthcare? Because, you know, I've seen this expression, someone in Wuhan sneezes, someone in Birmingham dies.
Yeah, COVID is, you know, it's just something we never could see happening. You know, it's worse than the influenza after the Great War. And we've had nothing like it, you know, for 102 years. And it's worse than it
but
was then.
Hang on, Chris, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we've had other pandemics. You know, yeah. Ebola jumped. We've had H1N1. We've had HIV. We've had the threat that there's going to be a viral disease that's highly transmissible and nasty. So surely people have been saying eventually one is going to get us. I mean, Hollywood's been making movies about it for years.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think we were a little complacent, because I think we talked about variant flus and we talked about Ebola. But at the Royal Free, we looked after all the British people who got affected by Ebola during the crisis. When you and I were at medical school, everybody died who had Ebola. And in fact, they all survived. And in a crisis, the rate at which we innovated in medicine was fantastic, and we made real progress, and there was less regulation, more investment in innovation. It was a great experience, but the numbers change all the time. But you know, it's over 130,000 people have died of COVID in this country, and all the things that we worried about, you know, HIV AIDS and influenza and avian flus and swine flus and Ebola, They're drops in the ocean compared to what's happened with COVID, and I don't think it's going to go away. We're going to be managing life with it, and it's been a profound change to the health service. There's probably been some good stuff that's come out of our response from it. I think the integrated care systems will have a better landing because of COVID, because we've been forced to work together during COVID, and actually people have quite liked it. And I think some of the relationships that are so important to make integration work are better than they were before. And I think that legacy will stay. So the working across systems will be better. I hope that the regulatory freedom about new treatments that happened during COVID. Regulation is a good thing and protects the public, but sometimes it can gain its own momentum and miss the point. And some of the regulatory freedom during the crisis, if you look at the development of vaccination, has been outstanding. And on a smaller scale, the development of novel treatments, monoclonal antibodies, and the answers we got about the effectiveness of dexamethasone in critically ill people came much quicker than it would have done without the selective pressure of a pandemic. So there's nothing good about a pandemic. There are some good things that came out of our response to the pandemic, which we need to not throw them away when it's gone. I think although it's a bit granular in detail and a bit for health service wonks, really, I think that there's some stuff about the better separation of elective care and emergency care that we need to develop more. We did during COVID, but we need to develop more of. So elective care really came to a standstill in the first wave of COVID and has slowed down and consecutive waves, and we have a huge backlog, and that will result in deaths, and you know, it's caused harm to patients already, but it's caused delays to cancer treatments and other treatments that will cause delays. And the number of cardiac operations, for instance, that we've done since COVID started is way below the original baseline. So I think we need to develop really pretty cleanly separate pathways between elective care and non-elective care. And some of that involves geographical separation of patients. We've done quite a lot of it, but we tend to sometimes organise health services to suit institutions and professionals rather than suit, you know, the public health need and the safety of patients. So I think cleaner, no pun intended, separation between elective work and emergency work is necessary and needs to be a permanent feature. There's an advantage to that, because in times of peace, there's likely to be a productivity gain in that, which will save money we can recycle to do more treatments. And I think there's got to be, and I'll probably talk about this more later, but there's got to be a bigger emphasis on keeping people well, on prevention, so that people are less vulnerable and stay away from hospitals, which are, you know, frankly not places you'd want to be if you didn't have to be in them.
Well, I know there's all sorts of discussions by all sorts of people. I just, you know, there's an expression in relation to the Holocaust, never forget. And I think we have to have the same mindset, because there will be another one. And I'm so very worried that the next one will be every bit as transmissible as this and a lot nastier. So yeah. We've also got to do with all the, the resistance, the anti-vaxxer community, the deniers, the conspiracy theorists. So I think we got a lot of work to do. So looking at, you've referenced the United States a few times, and I mentioned that I practiced there, as you know, for a number of years. Despite practicing for many years there, I really struggled to comprehend the varying continuing medical education demands state by state, the wide discrepancies in availability and quality of care. How do you see, and that's, you know, the Americans would say, well, that's an American problem, but we've got problems here too. How do you see that through the British lens?
Yeah, one of the things we've done at the Royal Free, and actually one of the reasons why I joined the Royal Free 4 years ago, is we've got a program called our clinical practice groups, which are designed to reduce variation in the delivery of care. And in fact, we borrowed the scheme from Intermountain Healthcare in Utah, in Salt Lake City. But essentially, there's a principle to that approach, which is you get patients and healthcare professionals around data, and you look at data and work out what healthcare looks like now, what a pathway for patients, so for, you know, for stroke or for pneumonia or for fractured neck of femur or whatever it is. And you look at it now, you look at the data, and the data is important to get clinician sign up. And then between you, including a patient voice, you say what it would look like in an ideal world. And then you design a pathway to get to that. Digitization is an important feature of that. So if you formalize the pathway into an electronic health record, you can, one, make sure that people adhere to these redesigned, I hope, idealized pathways. But also you can learn about them, you collect data about them, and you can have a continuous improvement loop where you can, you know, measure improvements and improve as you go along using a loop of continuous improvement, rather like the Institute for Health Improvement have advocated in New England. So we've tried within our hospital group to reduce variation in delivery of care, and have had some victories, but we're only one group of three hospitals. What I think is is the ambition is that we'll take that approach at least to the whole of our integrated care system for North Central London, and that we will look at pathways from beginning to end, so not just the hospital part of the pathway. So we've done some work recently on heart failure, where we're working, so we've got a cardiologist and a GP jointly leading a program of designing an ideal pathway, which is looking at the management of heart failure in the community, so people don't come in. So I think, despite our labeling as a National Health Service, we're almost a bit like a terrorist organization, where we've got several independent cells sort of linked by a common philosophy, but actually really quite separate, doing their own thing. And I hope with our ICSs, we can get to, ICSs are covering populations of about 2 million people. There are around 40 in England, so it's a bit less than 2 million. We can get some consistency, take out the variation in the delivery of care for those populations, but also we can have some sharing between those populations of 2 million people. And in an ideal world, I'm in a teaching hospital, and you're very familiar from your career of working in teaching hospital environments, that education and research are part of that. They're not extras, they're not luxuries. We talk about our tripartite mission. So research and education are as important as the clinical service. And if you teach well, the clinical service improves. And when I'm a patient, I want to be involved in clinical research as a patient, because I know you get a better outcome, as well as gaining for the future by learning that patients in trials get better outcome than historical patients. So it's bringing, I think, education, training and research under the same umbrella. I think the ICS is the right unit to start that on. But it'd be nice to get it, consistent over the whole health service.
I've heard it mentioned, Chris, that there's no N in the National Health Service. And yeah. I think that's absolutely true. And thanks for sharing that. So I want to get a bit personal here. You're a very well-trained and experienced clinician, and you've helped implement new approaches to address stroke. And you recently obtained a new and rather unhappily personal perspective on stroke. Would you care to share that with us?
Yeah, of course I would, Jonathan. It's helpful to talk about it. So on Easter Monday, I was washing up, and there's probably a life lesson there. And
a risk factor.
And I suddenly felt terrible, and I needed to lie down. I lay down on the kitchen floor, and my speech was funny, and my right side was weak. And I knew I was having a stroke. And so I asked my wife to phone an ambulance, and that I wanted to go to King's straight away, King's College Hospital, which is about 2 miles down the road and is one of the hyperacute stroke centres I helped set up. And I was taken there in incredibly rapidly. In fact, the most unpleasant physical bit about the experience was I just had a large tea, and I was travelling backwards, strapped to a stretcher over lots of speed bumps, and I was actually felt quite car sick. But anyway, I'd had a stroke. I got scanned. I was met by a neurologist as I arrived. I was scanned straight away, and I had a clot-busting drug less than an hour after my first symptom. So I had absolutely fabulous service. I was allowed to get up after my clot buster on day two. And on the second day, I needed two physiotherapists to help me walk from my bed to the toilet. And I was really quite disabled. I've had amazing treatment, particularly from physiotherapists and speech therapists and occupational therapists. And I've made pretty rapid progress. I can now cycle 30 miles on my beloved carbon fiber bike. And I swim quite a lot now. I ran a reasonably rapid 5 kilometer run 2 weeks ago, and I'm in quite good shape. My right side is not perfect, but I'm in quite good shape, and I count my blessings, and I'm very grateful for the hyperacute services, which were outstanding, and for the therapies that I've had, which have also been outstanding. I didn't know what I'd think if something bad happened to me, 6 months ago. I think it's something about doctors, Jonathan. I'm a bit weird because I wouldn't have predicted this, but I found the experience quite interesting, and I haven't been very downhearted about this. I didn't know how I'd react. But actually experiencing physical symptoms that you've described to other people, or you've asked other people about, and they're exactly as they're described in the textbooks, is a bit interesting. Seeing your own brain on a scanner lying down, with the clot busting drug going, is actually quite interesting. And then probably, less weirdly, but also interesting, is the real progress you can make with with very active physiotherapy. I've had two sadists as physiotherapists, Dan and Lucy. They're both brilliant, and I've loved both of them. And they put me through stuff as if they were frankly training a professional sportsman. And I've made progress doing that, and it's nice to see progress. But I count my blessings that I've had a good outcome. And I'm not unrealistic about the fact that I'm very well motivated. And before I had my stroke, I was fit, and that gave me a good start. But it's been interesting experiencing stuff as a user. And I've also, without being too soppy, I've been incredibly touched by how kind people have been. I think it maybe has made me a little kinder and a little more tolerant, which is not a bad thing.
It's an amazing story, Chris, and I'm thinking back to an experience I had when I got admitted to hospital and was hearing doctors talking at the end of my bed about me as if I was not there, and I very much was there. And I remember the part of the conversation where they were discussing whether or not I needed to be catheterized. And I remember that was a hell of a motivation. I don't know if you're familiar, but there's the American neuroscientist, Dr. Jill Bolt-Taylor. She had a cerebral bleed and wrote a memoir called A Stroke of Insight. And her TED talk, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is really inspirational. Do you have any plans to share your perspective more broadly within the Royal Free, within the healthcare system, for the general public? Because look, there are we're friends. You're a fit bloke. There's not an ounce of fat on you. You cycle like from here to Timbuktu. What should people listening do to protect their own health? And are you going to take this show on the road, if you will?
Yeah. So we're very aware, the Royal Free, that staff welfare is always important, and is more important post-COVID because people are quite tired. And so we've got a big program to think about staff welfare and well-being and health. And in some ways, charity begins at home. So if we can get our own staff to look after their cardiovascular health, particularly, smoking, alcohol, exercise, etc., it will be a good thing. And this is probably a lesson from me. I'm nearly vegetarian and exercise a lot, but I could have probably occasionally measured my own blood pressure and didn't. So I think there are some things internally at the Royal Free that we're going to do as part of a program, and I'll want to have a prominent part in that. The second thing is that when we changed stroke care in London, we wouldn't have done it without the Stroke Association. The Stroke Association were absolutely brilliant, and they kept us real. They made us focus on the patients and patient outcomes rather than the narrower interests of doctors and institutions. So I sort of feel I owe them one. So I've already I reached out to the chief exec of the Stroke Association, who I already knew, and I've met up with the Stroke Association, and I'm going to do some work with the Stroke Association from the point of view of, you know, I hate the term really, but an expert patient, and yeah. I'll try and do as much as I can to, you know, to help improve, you know, I suppose, knowledge of stroke and to try and improve other people's experience. I think what I'm slightly self-conscious about is I'm privileged. I've got privileged knowledge. I've got privileged connections in the service, and I was quite fit to start with. So everyone's experience of stroke is their own. It's not my experience. It's that bit we said at the beginning about humility, that I want to help, but I don't want to tell other people to be like me. I want them to be the best version of them, not another version of me.
Absolutely. My late dad had a great expression: don't judge people by your standards. So that's absolutely right. You know, Chris, I always like to finish off with some version of this question. If you were cycling through the countryside, as is highly likely you will be, and came across a genie who offered you three wishes, what would you ask for? And asking for your beloved biscuit men, Reading FC, to be back in the Premiership is a given. What wishes might you ask for?
Yeah, so I think reasonably easy, and I think would refer back, I hope, consistently to things I've already said. So I think my first wish is that prevention goes up the agenda, so that we're, you know, a health service, not an illness service, as I've already said. And, you know, there's nothing better than prevention. The second thing, which I think refers back to the stuff about integrated systems, is that we're joined up. I know many patients who have experienced the health service where they have good experiences in a bit of the health service, but that bit of the health service doesn't talk to the next bit of the health and social care system that they interact with. And I've had experience in my own family and also seeing other patients. So let's make the ICSs work and let's be joined up. And then the third thing is it's a bit like, you know, world peace really, but I just like us to be a bit kinder to each other. I was really glad you used the word kindness early on. I think in all sorts of ways, and maybe it's, you know, the last 20 years since 9/11, we've become less kind. We're less tolerant of difference. You know, our attitude towards immigration and minorities is less tolerant than it used to be. Whereas for most of my lifetime, we've become more tolerant. So I'd like us to get back. And the way to start, it's like, you know, charity beginning at home, is we should all start trying to be a bit kinder to each other and then hope that spreads. So it's a plea for kindness, really.
Chris Streeter, thanks so much for joining us today and for your perspectives and insights, certainly your professional ones, which are spot on target, but also the personal insights, which teach us about humanity and also that, you know, as physicians, we don't get a pass on healthcare issues. And I'm sure everyone who's listening in will join me in wishing you a continued recovery. And thank you for all you do for healthcare here and globally. And I don't know if you've heard the term, Chris, but whenever I'm out and about and I see chaps wearing cycling gear, I've heard the term mammals, middle-aged men in Lycra. It's a cracker. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks. From a proud mammal, thanks very much. Thanks, Jonathan.
So, folks, that's it for today. Please check out prior shows in the EMG Health Archives or wherever you get your podcasts. And join me next week for what will hopefully be another great conversation. Until then, stay safe, stay well, stay curious. Bye for now.